Good afternoon. I'm David Chappell. Welcome to this talk on Microsoft Azure for Enterprises, what and why. And more than that, welcome to TechEd. It's fun to be here, isn't it? I haven't been here for 5 years, 5 years since my last TechEd year, but it's great to be back. I'm really happy to be here. I'm not quite as happy, though, to have the post-lunch slot, right? All of our blood's in the stomachs, not in our heads. It's hard to think, right? But we'll do our best. I want to prepare you for this session because I want to make sure that you are going to get what you want. When you learn about a new technology, I would suggest that there are three things you might be interested in. One is what the technology is. The second is why you should care. And the third is how you can use it. TechEd is very much a how conference. There's all kinds of demos and examples and how. I will not do any how. This talk has no demos, no code, no screenshots. If you're here to learn how to configure something or how to write an app, you're in the wrong place. This talk is totally about the what and the why, not the how. I am convinced that learning about how before you know what and why is worthless. The what and why drives everything. And so that's my focus next hour and 15 minutes. The what and the why of Azure specifically for enterprises, by which I mean effectively organizations, government, businesses of all sizes. To me, the term enterprise just means any non-personal thing. Governments, large businesses, small businesses, anything like that. Okay? That's my focus. I should also tell you, as is obvious from the slide, I don't work for Microsoft. What this represents is my perspective, which is derived from several years of spending much of my time flying around the world talking to folks about cloud platforms, about Azure specifically. So my goal here is to show you what I think I've learned in the years of doing this. Okay? So let's start. Here is my primary contention, the main idea of this session. It is my opinion that nearly every enterprise today can benefit from using public cloud platforms. And perhaps this whole session might be viewed as an argument that supports that main idea. To talk about this, however, I'm going to start in a place that might surprise you. I'm going to start with how change happens, with how innovation occurs. Because think about this. Here's a chart. It graphs time against competitive advantage. Think about the first organization, the very first one, to successfully implement some new innovation. Think about, for example, the first airline to have check-in kiosks, or the first gas station to pay at the pump, or the first smartphone company to do big touchscreens. The first firm in an industry to do some new thing gets substantial advantage, don't they, if it's successful? But then what happens? What happens is you can't keep good ideas secret, and so somebody else in the same industry will copy that. Do they also get advantage? Yes, they do. As much as the first? Probably not. And then what happens? Well, the third firm copies the innovation. And now, do they get advantage? Well, not very much. There's a curve here. What begins as an innovation becomes an obligation. Today, an airline with no check-in counters is uncompetitive. A smartphone with no big touchscreen won't get purchased. Innovations start providing advantage. They wind up being a cost of entry. What begins as an innovation becomes an obligation. And so, you can think about IT spending, the money we spend on technology, in terms of this chart. You can say there is a window of differentiation. There's a period of time in which innovations create true business advantage. But eventually, everything slides down that curve. Let's think of the IT spending that supports business differentiation, business advantage, as strategic IT. It supports true differentiation, true strategy in the Michael Porter sense. Everything else, let's call utility IT. Why is this interesting? Why am I doing this? What does this have to do with cloud platforms? Well, I'll tell you. Turns out that when you think about applications in the two parts of this curve, You want quite different things, don't you? Because in the strategic phase, applications need to be able to support new and modern business ideas. You want the ability to have elastic resources and to have fast development. You are innovating. In that first part of the curve, the strategic part, you are innovating. And so what you want from your environment, your infrastructure, is those things. Eventually, though, all the apps slide down the curve, become utility. In the utility phase, you want something very different. There you care about what? Low cost, high reliability. This conflict is at the heart of so much pain in our industry, isn't it? It's very difficult to do both these things at once. But the reason this is relevant to us this afternoon is that public cloud platforms such as Microsoft Azure can help with both of these things. They have value in both phases. And later on, I'm going to walk through a bunch of scenarios that try to illustrate why you might use and how you might use Azure technologies in each of those scenarios. I'll divide into those two categories. Before I do that, however, we have to spend just a few minutes talking about the technology of Azure. Now, here's the thing. As I'm sure some of you know, Azure is a big, complex thing. Azure has lots and lots and lots of technologies. New ones appear all the time. One appeared this morning. New ones appear all the time. For enterprises, however, getting started with Azure, the majority scenarios use only a few technologies. You need know, I would argue, only a little bit about the Azure technology to actually think intelligently about the way most organizations begin adopting public cloud platforms. And so what follows is in no way a complex technology tutorial. Rather, it's meant to be very straightforward and simple. As I'm sure you all know, Azure provides its services in data centers around the world. There's a bunch in the US, there's some in Europe, there's several in Asia, more on the way, Australia, Brazil, there's lots of them. The minute everybody looks at this, the minute people think about the fact that public cloud platforms mean they will run their apps and store their data in data centers owned by somebody else, e.g. Microsoft, in some other country? In Europe, the data centers are in Amsterdam and Dublin, okay? So for most of you, you'd store things in some other country. The moment people realize this, everyone has the exact same question. The question is always some variation of this. It is, can a public cloud platform really keep my applications and my data safe? I got to tell you, the truth is, that's the polite version of this question. More often, people say to me, David, are you out of your mind? I'm going to put my data in some data center in Dublin or Amsterdam or Singapore? Are you nuts? What about security, they say? What about security? It's always the first question, and it's an entirely rational question. However, it's the wrong question. And here's why it's the wrong question. It's the wrong question because all of us who run data centers, let me ask, who in the room has at least some responsibility for a data center? Anybody? Yeah, a lot of you, right. So some of you, I am sure, lay awake at night thinking about this. You think, gee, are my firewall settings correct? That last admin I hired, her resume, was she really what I wanted? Can I trust her? You worry about these things because it's your job to worry about them. If you adopt a public cloud platform such as Azure, those things stop being your problem. Ultimately, this question is not about security. This question is about trust. You have to learn to trust your public cloud provider because Microsoft, for example, will let you tour data centers. You can walk through. They'll point. They'll say, look, over there, servers. Look, over there, more servers. What you cannot do, however, is examine the firewall settings or check administrator resumes. You can't do those things. You have to trust them. You have to trust them. The issue is not security. The issue is trust. How do you build trust? Well, the answer usually is slowly. You start small, you dip your toe in. If there's value and things work out okay, you take the next step. As we walk through scenarios here, I'm going to show you how most people start. Most people start with small, low-risk scenarios. Now, would Microsoft like you to move your whole world to Azure tomorrow? Probably. Is that rational for most of you? No. No. And so I almost never see that. Startups do that. But established firms don't do that, generally. Okay? But please recognize, this issue of security is not really about security. It's about trust. Now, to be clear, you still own your app. So if your app has lousy password policies, you're in trouble. Okay. But in terms of data center security, that is no longer your concern. I encounter CIOs who will say to me, David, they will say, you know, I think that my data center is more secure than Microsoft's. And I say, really? I think you're probably wrong. If you work for the NSA, maybe you're okay. Although, let's talk about that, should we? The NSA. Remember, once again, I do not work for Microsoft. My personal opinions. When I heard about the Edward Snowden revelations, as an American citizen, which I am, I was disappointed. What I was not, however, was surprised. Who in the room was surprised by those revelations? Who was surprised? I see no hands. Right. So before Snowden, we all thought they could access our data. After Snowden, we know for sure. What is different exactly? I do not see lots of different behavior post-Snowden because the expectations haven't really changed in my experience. And think about this. What did Snowden do? Snowden walked out of a top secret NSA data center with a USB stick containing 50,000 top secret documents. If the NSA cannot secure their top secret data centers, do you think you can? The real lesson of Snowden, perhaps, is that we can never trust on-prem data centers. Your perspective, right? You get to decide these things. Those are my perspectives. And again, I'm not Microsoft. Those are my personal views. So we'll see what happens here. The point is, this is really about trust, and you have to build trust if you choose to use these technologies. How do you do that? We'll see slowly. And I got to say one more thing. People are so irrational about trust. I talk to CIOs who will say to me, David, I would never put my critical data on a public cloud platform. And then they'll send me confidential documents via Dropbox, which runs on Amazon. People are just not rational. Or here's my favorite example. My favorite example. Ask yourself this. What is the world's most dangerous technology? What is the world's scariest technology? Is it nuclear weapons? Is it some computer virus to wipe all our systems? No. No. The world's most dangerous technology, the world's scariest technology, is actually Windows Update. Okay, you laugh, but every Patch Tuesday, Microsoft puts right into your operating system whatever code they feel like. And you just say, click, install. Now, maybe you test to make sure things aren't broken by the updates, but do you check to make sure that the last update, or maybe the next one, doesn't steal all your data? You don't. You don't because you trust Microsoft. My point here is the level of trust we already have in Microsoft, as evinced by our use of Windows Update, is probably greater than what Azure asks of us. People are irrational about this issue. Nonetheless, I would never encourage anybody to move wholesale tomorrow to public cloud platform. I would, however, encourage you to give it a try. I think there are real benefits here. I think there are ways to build trust slowly over time, which we'll talk about. After this, the next question is always the following. It's always, okay, David, suppose I'm willing to maybe start trying to build some trust. What about compliance? Could I still meet my legal requirements in the public cloud? The answer here gets more complex in my experience. You have to follow the rules that apply to you. And that can be difficult. Why? Because the rules vary across different vertical markets, financial services, retailing, healthcare, governments, and they vary across countries. They're different here in Spain than the UK or France or Germany or the US or Sweden or whatever. The result is this matrix of laws and regulations, which probably nobody in the whole world really understands. And so it can be complicated. Some thoughts about this. First, when people think about public cloud platforms, they very often start in their minds with their most critical systems and most secure data. They think, put my ERP in the public cloud? What? Nobody starts there. Almost nobody starts there. Your data has a range of regulatory and security requirements, from most to least. Most folks don't start over here. They start here. Or maybe they start here. So please don't think about your most secure stuff. Some of that may never go in the cloud. We'll see. Second, what I have found in talking to firms around the world about this is that if you follow the rules, get your lawyers involved, do all this work, many, even most firms, can do more than they thought they could in the public cloud. So I would encourage you not to be a showstopper, but to be aware of these issues. I mean, come on. The success of Office 365, of Salesforce.com, of the growing range of SaaS applications, it illustrates that this stuff can be dealt with. Is it problematic? Sometimes, yes. Is it insurmountable? Typically, in my experience, no. But these issues are always fundamental. You've got to start with them. Now, to understand the scenarios I'm going to walk through, you've got to have some very basic grasp of the technology. So here comes the world's shortest Windows Azure tutorial. It's 3 slides long. Okay, ready? Make sure we're all on the same page. Oh, I'm sorry. I got 2 more objections here to address first. Forgive me. Let me do these, then I'll come back to my tutorial. The next one here is availability. People say, well, wait a minute. How could I trust those data centers to be up? And the answer here is, well, there are outages. Don't compare to perfection. Compare to your own data center. It's not legitimate, it's not fair to say, well, wait a minute, they're down sometimes. Yeah, well, so are you. Right? And the issue is, are they at least as good as you? Probably. Probably. And there are SLAs, which pay financial penalties, which is a good thing. And finally, this is a worry that I find is often in the minds of IT people about public cloud technologies that is very rarely spoken. The worry is this. If my firm moves toward public cloud, whether it's Exchange Online or Azure, will I lose my job? Am I going to lose my job here? And the answer, in my experience thus far, is probably not. Is it absolutely not? No. I think that some parts of IT are going to shrink in employment over the next 10 years as public cloud takes off. But for most of us, the answer is probably not. But we will have to learn some new skills. Now, maybe you're thinking, but I like what I do, and I like my skill set, and I like this. Yeah, well, people who don't like change should not work in technology. If you thought that your current skill set was going to last you your whole career, you were wrong. You were just wrong. So this brings change, but that's the nature of our business, isn't it? You know, when I finished computer science grad school a long time ago, 84, I was convinced the language I knew and loved would be the one programming language for my entire career because I loved it so much. It was a language called Pascal. Remember Pascal? It's been dead for decades, right? It's the nature of our industry. Things just change. We have to learn new stuff. All right, now comes the world's shortest Azure tutorial. For compute to run applications, there are 2 big categories. One of them is commonly called IaaS, Infrastructure as a Service. Actually, Europeans say EaaS by and large, don't they? I'm going to say I as an American, so forgive me here. Europeans also commonly say Azure, I've noticed. Well, Americans more often say Azure, so I don't know what's right, but I am who I am. IaaS is a very simple idea. You go to a website, you say, give me a VM, and the VM starts running for you in a few minutes. Great. When you're done, you shut it down. That's IaaS. Very straightforward. There's also two different options in Azure for this thing called PaaS, Platform as a Service. The idea in PaaS is your apps are still running in VMs, but you don't see the VMs anymore. With PaaS, you say, cloud platform, here's my app, run my app. It does it for you. You don't create VMs to manage and so on. You just say, here's my app, run my app. So IaaS versus PaaS. Both of those things are available in Azure. In Azure, the technology called virtual machines is the main thing for IaaS. For PaaS, it looks like the technology called websites is emerging as the dominant PaaS technology, my opinion. Great. And then for data, there are various options. The most important, I would argue today, for a lot of enterprises, is also the simplest. It's blobs. Blob is an acronym for binary large object. It's like a big sand in the sky, just big binary files. Great. Files is the wrong word. Big binary chunks of data. You can also, of course, run database systems in a VM. I think of this as IaaS relational storage. You can run SQL Server, you can run MySQL, you can run NoSQL technologies, whatever you want. And there's PaaS relational storage in this thing called SQL Database. Turns out that for most of the things we're going to talk about here today, IaaS, blobs are the whole story. In terms of actual market share revenue today, public cloud platforms, IaaS and blobs are the large majority across the industry. IaaS and blobs are the two defining technologies that matter the most right now. Others are important, but in terms of scenarios, in terms of revenue, those two are the big guys right now in this space. If you're interested, I'm doing a talk tomorrow that compares Azure against other public cloud platforms like Amazon. Make the point again there, because it's true. Those are the big two pieces of the story right now. And you'll see in the scenarios, they're the big two things. One more thing worth discussing. You have data centers. Azure has data centers. You want to connect them. There are various ways to do that. In some ways, the most interesting is this thing called Azure Virtual Network. You can define a VPN between your world and their world, which makes the VMs on Azure appear to be on your network. In fact, those VMs have IP addresses drawn from your IP space. So, a way to extend the data center to include things in Azure. And that's it. There are more, but in terms of core technologies, that's all you have to understand about Azure to grasp the core scenarios with which enterprises commonly start using this technology. However, not always, but much of the time, the reason people want to use Azure is to save money. And so to understand those arguments, you have to know the basics of Azure pricing. It looks like this. For most people, their bills have three main components. One is compute. You spend money on VMs. You pay for VMs by the hour. And the prices range from really cheap, 2 cents an hour, to $1.32, depending on how big they are and how fancy they are and so on. Data. Blob storage is really very cheap, from 2 cents to about 6 cents per gig per month. SQL Database can be very cheap, $5 a month, or very expensive, almost $4,000 a month for a big, giant, fancy thing. You've got options there, right? The third component, compute and data, is bandwidth. You do not pay for data sent into Azure data centers. Microsoft is happy to have you give them data they can then charge you to store. They're good with that. But to move data out of Azure, they charge you. You see the prices here. They vary based on where you are and how much you send. The more you send, the cheaper it gets. All right? Now, two comments about this slide. Number one, if you have enterprise agreements, you will not see these prices. You'll get discounts. Second, I review this slide before every time I give this talk, because the prices change frequently. The thing you know about that is they always change in one direction. They always go down. I'll come back to this point later on. It's important. And I see people taking pictures of my slides. I'm flattered. Thank you. Feel free to, I'll send you the deck, right? Or a PDF of the deck. So you need not do this if you don't want to, but you can. All right. So that's all you have to know to make sense out of Azure. The basics of mostly IaaS and blobs, those are the most important things, and pricing, how it basically works. You pay as you use. So once you know these things, we can now start walking through scenarios, starting with utility. I told you I would divide the scenarios according to the curve I showed earlier. Well, there's the curve again. We're going to start on the utility side. That's the area where you probably care the most about better reliability and lower cost. In strategic, our second section, you want other things. And so it's useful to think about these in two separate categories. For utility, I'm going to talk about data storage. You'll see a couple scenarios here. I'm going to talk about identity, cloud identity, VMs on demand, especially for dev test environments, disaster recovery, and deploying packaged apps like SharePoint, and eventually, moving existing apps to the public cloud. Again, most folks don't start at the last one. They start near the top because there is, to some extent, a risk gradient here. The ones at the top have the least risk, at the bottom, perhaps the most. People tend to start at the top with small things, dip their toe in the Azure water, and move their way down if they are successful. All right? So let's start at the top. Azure blobs. Really cheap, really simple. They can be used in various ways. There is this thing called Store Simple, which is actually hardware, an appliance that lets you use Azure blobs. The next slide is about that. It's worth a bit more detail than this quick overview here, so I'll get there in a second. People also commonly use blobs for backup. They're available, they're cheap. There's built-in support for doing blob-based backup in Windows Server, in SQL Server, other things today. Applications can also use blobs to store anything they want, binary data, videos, whatever. Blobs are just big, cheap chunks of binary data. Now, it turns out that among the most common ways that people begin using blob storage is the red box on the left. It's the Store Simple scenario. Here's how that works. In your data center today, you have users, obviously, who use apps running on servers, and you have storage. Maybe you have SANs, maybe you have other things. You've got storage. Store Simple, which is a company Microsoft bought a while ago, provides this actual appliance, this physical device that you wheel in and install in your data center. It has local disk. It acts kind of like a SAN, except it is connected on the back end to Azure Blobs. It moves data back and forth to the local disk and Azure Blobs as needed. For example, you can configure it so that data that's not accessed for a while gets shoved off to Blobs. So the Store Simple device can act like a cache, on-premises cache. The data that's moved to Blobs, you can see here, is compressed, it is deduped, it is encrypted. That's really important. It is encrypted, and the key is held by you, not by Microsoft. People like that. It's one of the reasons why folks start here, because they feel somewhat lower risk because the encryption happens and the key is held by you, not Microsoft. So should some legal action or some NSA secret thing access your data in the cloud, all they'll get is encrypted data without the key, unless they come to you. Now, maybe you think NSA can crack all known forms of encryption. Separate issue. I don't know. Why do people do this? Why do people use blob storage? The answer, in my experience, overwhelmingly is lower cost. It's about money. So here's a simple example. Suppose I store a terabyte of data in geo-redundant blobs. What does that mean? What's a geo-redundant blob? Here's what it means. In every part of the world, Microsoft has groups of data centers. In Europe, for example, there's the Dublin data centers and Amsterdam. If I store a blob in Amsterdam, and by the way, just to be clear, you always tell Azure where to put something. You always know, oh, my data is in Amsterdam, it's in Dublin, it's in Singapore. It's not the case that your data goes into this amorphous cloud and is stored somewhere. No, you control where it lives. So you can put your data in Amsterdam. You can turn on the option for geo-redundancy. If you do that, your blob is copied automatically to Dublin, other data center in the same region. And updates are moved there as well. Why would you do that? Disaster recovery. If Dublin's destroyed or down for some reason, the data's still in Amsterdam. It's an option. It costs more money. I chose to use that option here because I want to show you the most expensive option for what are called block blobs. So if I'm storing a terabyte in geo-redundant blobs, if I'm doing 10 million reads and writes per month on that, turns out you're charged a tiny bit for each read and write, I'll show you. If I'm moving half a terabyte out each month, the pricing looks like this. Storage, $61 a month. Operations, 36 cents for your 10 million reads and writes. They're really cheap. Data transfer, it varies based on where you are. The total here for the US and Europe, it's about 100 bucks a month. 100 bucks a month for a terabyte of geo-redundant data. My experience is that most enterprises know their storage costs. So tell me, is that expensive? Is that cheap? I know the answer. The answer is it's cheap. It's quite cheap. And it gets cheaper all the time. If I were here a year ago, that was about something like 160. It's a bunch more. If I'm here a year from now, what will it be? I don't know. It'll be less. These keep on going down. Keep on going down. So this is why people use Azure Blob Storage, because it's cheap. It's also, as I said, relatively low risk to get started. And so as a beginning scenario for Azure, for public cloud platforms, this is among the most common for enterprises. Another one that's getting more and more common is identity. There's this thing announced not too long ago called Azure AD. There's an option called Azure AD Premium that you pay for. It's very interesting. It looks like this. You all have, I'm pretty sure, Windows Server Active Directory in your environments. You all run classic AD, right? I'm going to call that Windows Server AD on this slide, to be clear. It is possible for an IT admin to configure a link between Windows Server AD on premises and Azure AD in the cloud. Don't be confused. Azure AD is not a copy of Windows Server AD in the cloud. No, it is totally different. I have moments when I wish it were not called Active Directory because it's really different. But nonetheless, it's called Azure AD. Okay? You can connect your on-prem Windows Server AD to in the cloud Azure AD. If you do this, your user can then log in as always. And once they've done that, they have single sign-on to, of course, their own on-prem applications, but also to SaaS applications, cloud applications, software as a service, running on Azure. So with Azure AD, you can have a single login, no more passwords, to on-prem, just one password, sorry, the usual one, for the domain login, to your access of your on-premises applications and your apps running on Azure. And you think, okay, I'd expect that. Microsoft, of course, lets me log into Windows apps and apps on Azure. The thing that is surprising, at least to me, about Azure AD is this. It is that once you've logged in, you've got single sign-in to both on-premises apps and SaaS apps running on Azure, as well as to SaaS apps running in other cloud environments. This is not just for Microsoft-based apps. So, why do folks do this? People do this, in my experience, because they want single sign-on to diverse SaaS applications. Yes, O365, Microsoft CRM Online, but this thing also supports, out of the box, single sign-on access to Google Apps, to Salesforce, to a bunch more things. Microsoft is clearly trying to make this the Active Directory of the new cloud world. Stop for a second here. You know, I'm sure, that more and more packaged apps are becoming SaaS apps, right? As those SaaS apps take over our world, what becomes the Active Directory of that world? Answer, Microsoft wants this to be that. And so what we're seeing here is support not just for Microsoft's apps, but also for those from other vendors. Single sign-on for a diverse range of things. It also provides multi-factor authentication. What does that mean? It means that login can be set to require both a password and the entry of a code sent to your mobile phone. That's important. You know, the recent hacking of the celebrities' pictures that we read about, Jennifer Lawrence and so on, if they had MFA, they wouldn't have a problem. They lacked MFA, thus they had that problem. MFA is very important. And finally, this thing provides administration, things like self-service password resets for SaaS apps, reports of who accessed what, and so on. So this is also, in my experience, a place where enterprises begin using Azure. Why? It's useful. If you have multiple SaaS applications, it's useful. And the risk is relatively low. At most, what's in the cloud is a hash of your password. So, as I said before, people commonly start small, they build trust. Starting with storage, like Store Simple, starting here, classic places to start to get value without taking too much risk. A third place where organizations start using public cloud platforms is this. It's VMs on demand for a dev test environment. The idea here is that an IT admin or developer uses the Azure Management Portal to create some VMs using Azure Virtual Machines, the IaaS technology. A dev team can then use those VMs as they see fit for dev tests. Why would you do this? People do this because it's fast and easy, and it's cheap. You can get VMs that cost very little and use them with your own VHDs or Microsoft's VHDs. You can use Windows or Linux. You can do access if they were local. You can have a VPN set up here. And they're not just for dev test. I see firms also use these for proof of concept, other innovation type solutions. And you can shut them down when you're not using them. So dev teams that don't work on nights or weekends can have no VMs running and save money. In my experience, developers like this because it lets them not be constrained by the rules of central IT. In my experience, central IT doesn't always like this because developers are no longer constrained by the rules of central IT. There is this conflict here. Nonetheless, this can be hard to stop. It's a low-risk way to start using public cloud. Why? Because it's not mission critical, it's development. And also because the data you're using in the cloud is probably test data, and thus not so subject to regulations as other things might be. So it's a common place to start using public cloud. Storage, identity, VMs for dev test. The three, in my experience, most common entry points for low-risk use of Azure. Once folks have more trust, or perhaps if they start with more trust, they might start with things like this, disaster recovery. This is an expanding area on Azure. And it's a very diverse set of scenarios. There's lots of things that fit in this category. I'm going to show you a simple one. They get bigger all the time. A simple one is just doing database failover to Azure. Here, you might have an administrator, again, create some Azure VMs, install SQL Server in that VM, or choose a VM with SQL Server installed already, and then create this thing called an always-on availability group. If you do that, changes made to the on-premises master are copied to the cloud secondary. If the on-premises master fails, the application can automatically redirect to the cloud-based version. So you might use this for disaster recovery just for your database. Why do folks do this? Well, there are, as I said, a bunch of ways to use it. There are lots of scenarios. There is this thing called Azure Site Recovery, for example, that allows replicating Hyper-V VMs more broadly. A much broader scenario than this, and Microsoft tells us that they're going to relatively soon come out with a way to support VMware VMs here as well. And that'll be a big change. That'll be a big change. Why use IaaS in general for disaster recovery? Well, it's probably obvious, isn't it? It's just going to be cheaper. You know, today, if I want to do disaster recovery, what do I have to do? Very often, I've got to have this data center that sits there doing nothing most of the time. Here, with IaaS, I can have VMs ready to go and not spin them up, most of them at least, till I need them. When I'm done with the disaster, shut them down. Probably, IaaS will make disaster recovery much cheaper in public cloud platforms. And that means that I can do disaster recovery for all kinds of apps, not just the main things. So I will be shocked if in the next few years, most DR does not move to IaaS-based public clouds. It makes so much financial sense. And also, if you want recovery around the world, there are data centers around the world to recover in. So there are options there. We're still marching up the trust gradient here. People feel differently about this, but in my experience, often it takes a while before enterprises will do something like this next step, before they'll deploy packaged apps on Azure. Now, I know some that start with this, certainly, but in my experience, it's less common than starting with the smaller things we discussed already. But I can deploy a packaged app like SharePoint on Azure. I can even establish that virtual network connection, so I've got a VPN, and I can do this. I can run Active Directory in both places. Please don't be confused here, because this is confusing. What I mean here is I'm connecting on-premises Windows Server Active Directory to an instance of Windows Server Active Directory domain controller running on Azure. This is not Azure AD. This is actually running a domain controller in Azure. Why would I do this? Because SharePoint wants it. SharePoint talks to AD quite a bit. And so having a domain controller in the cloud can be a good thing to do. This is not Azure AD. I might do that as well. But for this scenario, it might make good sense to run a classic domain controller in the cloud, which I can do, and connect that to the on-prem AD. Then I've got things set up very nicely. I can have some VMs. I can deploy SharePoint. My farm, SQL Server, my users don't know the difference. To them, this looks local. Why would I do this? Why would anybody deploy SharePoint on Azure rather than their own data center? Well, here are the most common reasons I see. Number one, faster deployment. This is especially true for business units that don't need to wait for central IT. You know this story, right? Some business unit goes to IT and says, we need a new SharePoint farm. And IT says, yes, you bet. No problem. We'll get right to it in 6 to 9 months. And the business says, really? If I use this, the business says, I can have VMs this afternoon and start right now. Why should I wait for you? Going around central IT, in my experience, is a big reason why people want to do this. Now, some of you I know are thinking the following. You're thinking, but wait, you're thinking, I am central IT. I don't want them going around me. Yeah, right. I appreciate that. However, let me tell you, I've had this conversation with lots and lots and lots and lots of IT leaders around the world. I've never, ever seen an IT leader, stop the business from doing this. Never. Even if your CIO is a graduate of the Joseph Stalin School of IT Management, they're not going to win this battle. Why? Because fundamentally, we work for them, right? We work for them. They always win. And so, it's a much better solution, I believe, for IT leaders to not try to block this stuff, but rather to become the concierge, to become the helpful person when the business wants to do this. If you don't do that, the business will do whatever they want and adopt multiple technologies and be chaotic. So trying to stop this, in my experience, is hopeless, doesn't work. Trying to work with them to bring some structure, some rationality about the choices, can be much more effective. But remarkably, in my experience, this is the most common reason why business units want to do this. They also will say things like this. They'll say, well, this makes IT into OpEx, not CapEx, because you're now paying for VMs by the month rather than upfront investment. There are people who present that as a big win for cloud platforms. I don't know. My experience is CFOs vary. Some CFOs love the idea of IT as OpEx, not CapEx. Others hate it. So it depends on your company. But for those that want more OpEx and less CapEx, this is a good thing. And finally, lower cost. Lower cost. I'm going to come back to this in a minute, and I said this earlier. Prices keep going down. You know why? You know why? Because in this market, there are really three big players and a bunch of smaller ones. There's Microsoft, Amazon, and Google as the big players. And all three sell IaaS VMs and blobs and other stuff. Well, IaaS VMs and blobs, which, as I said before, are the bulk of the market in terms of money, are pretty similar across all these vendors. They're pretty similar. You've got these massive vendors making huge investments in data centers, selling things that are quite similar, IaaS VMs and blobs. What does that do to prices? Answer, it drops them to costs. So what we're seeing here is just these massive price decreases periodically because of these big competing vendors. This will keep on happening. So price drops happen frequently. Expect them to keep on going down. Once organizations really have more trust, and not until then, in my experience, they will start doing this. They will start moving their apps to the public cloud. Lots of folks, when they first encounter Azure, think about this first and think, I would never do that. Well, you probably wouldn't start here, but you might get here eventually over time. And so if you imagine, again, the environment with the VPN, with AD domains in both places, I can now have some nice VMs. I can move my apps. My users just don't care. Okay? Why would I do this? Why would I move my on-premises applications to the public cloud? Well, you know the answer, right? Overwhelmingly, the answer is going to be lower cost. Again, here's an example. Suppose my app requires two medium-sized VMs, 18 cents an hour each. By the way, I quote prices here in dollars because that's how Microsoft quotes them. They're then moved into local currencies around the world, but the official prices are all in dollars, which is why I quote them in dollars here. I've got some assumptions about the size of the database, data transfer. It's not a big app. It's not a big app by any means. The pricing comes out like this for compute, for storage, for bandwidth. The total, US and Europe, $280 a month to run this app. Now, earlier I showed you the pricing for data. And I said, is that expensive? Is that cheap? You were quiet. It's a big group. But I'm sure many of you are thinking, OK, I know that's cheap, because you know your data costs. In my experience, looking at this number, $280 per month, almost none of you can say whether expensive or cheap, because you don't know what it costs to run your apps. You don't think in these terms. So you might start thinking of these terms going forward. And especially, you might do this. You might say, well, wait a minute, $280 a month to run one app, times 12, what is that? $3,000-$4,000 a month, for a year? I can buy a server for that much. How in the world can this be cheaper? What are you talking about? Well, you got to be careful here. You must do apples to apples comparisons. People do this all the time. They will say, well, that app costs that much, so I can buy a small server for that. Why would I do this? It's because you aren't doing the fully burdened cost. There's the server, there's the power, data center space, cooling, people to administer it, all that stuff. You must do fully burdened costs. If you do that, the comparisons, I believe, get more attractive. And again, if today is too expensive, jump out a year, 3 years, 5 years. I promise you, these large-scale cloud data centers will be cheaper than your on-prem data center if they're not already. They're going to be because of this massive competition among big players in this space. There's an analogy that's often made. Maybe you've heard this. It's not original with me. Here's the analogy. In the late 19th century, factories around the world began to electrify. They changed their systems to use electric motors in the factories. When they first did this, the factories all had to run their own generators to produce power. And they did. But over time, it became evident that it was actually better to have giant shared utilities that offered big generators at lower cost. It took a while. People had learned to trust them. But eventually, the big shared power facilities became so much cheaper, so much better, that today almost no one runs their own generator anymore. We rely on shared utilities. Are they perfect? No. They're down sometimes, but not very often, not very much. It's better. You can think about cloud computing in the same way. It is entirely possible. I think it's actually quite likely. The same thing's happening in our world right now. Having massive shared compute utilities, cloud platforms, is going to be a better solution than having us all run our own generators. Think about it. Does your business want to run an IT organization? Do they want to run data centers? Find me the CEO of a non-technology company who loves writing checks for data centers. They do not. They want the benefits of IT, not to run data centers. It's like power utilities. And so, I'm expecting to see a world emerge next 5-10 years where that's the norm, just as the world changed from generators for factories to shared power sources. All right. So I've walked through utility IT. These are the scenarios I most often see organizations use. Let's take our last 20 minutes, look at the first part of the curve. Strategic IT. The idea here is really about new applications, because that's what you're doing in strategy with IT, building new applications almost all the time. And so I want to categorize apps into three big buckets. New apps that face employees, internally facing. New apps that face customers, externally facing. And in their own category, parallel apps. Why their own category? I'll show you in a minute. Before we look at these, however, let's just step back and go meta one more time and think about why organizations even build new applications. I would suggest to you that there are two big reasons. Reason number one is they build an app that improves the execution, the operation of some existing business model. The canonical example here is automating a business process. Great. It doesn't change the business model, it just makes it better. The other big reason to do this is you build a new app to support the creation of a new business model, entering some whole new field, like customer self-service to services. Why am I doing this? Because this talk is about what and why. And this is very much about the why. Why do you build cloud applications? Why can the cloud change what you do in this area? Well, I would encourage you to think about this in terms of your business models. Now, if you're like me, You spent years hating that term business model.
I hated that term because it was so undefined, so amorphous, so confusing. But today I love that term business model. And the reason is I discovered this thing called Business Model Canvas, which provides a very clear way to think about this.
It's a very simple idea. I'm going to spend 3 minutes on this. It's a very simple idea. There are 9 boxes describing your business model. At the heart is your value prop. What are you offering? On the right are your customers. What segments are you targeting? What channels used to reach them? What relationships are allowed by those channels? On the left is infrastructure, your key activities, processes, key resources, key partners. At the bottom is money, your cost structure, your revenue stream. Why is this interesting? First of all, it's from this book I list right there, not original at all. Who's ever seen this before? A few of you. The rest of you, I'm telling you people, this whole session was worthwhile because you saw this. Go buy this book. This is such a useful idea for thinking about business models. It's very useful. For cloud, for example, thinking about how new apps can change your world, if you march through all 9 boxes with your organization, how can cloud platforms like Azure make a difference in your business? This can provide a structured way to have that conversation. So for example, can you reach different kinds of customers through cloud applications? Maybe. Can your channels change, your relationships change by allowing self-service? Can you perhaps repurpose in-house IT resources? Probably you can. Do you need to deal with massive cheap compute? I was hired a while ago by the leadership team of a big European financial services company to do a private tutorial for their CEO, CIO, CFO, and cloud technology. Coming in, these guys had the belief that their large investment in data structures and IT resources was a competitive advantage, was a unique thing. And it was for a long, long time. But not anymore. Today, 2 guys, laptop, credit card, have access to global class data centers. Big change in business models, potentially. Who are your key partners? Choose your cloud platform intelligently. This is bound to change your cost structure. It can change revenues as well because you can try more stuff. It's now much less risky to try new things. That's why all startups use cloud platforms. I live outside San Francisco. In Silicon Valley, if you go to a venture capital firm with your great new idea and include money for a data center, they will laugh you out of the room. Right? All startups use cloud platforms all the time because they're better for innovation, cheaper, less risky. That could be for you as well, not just small startups. So, having said this, let's go back to some scenarios. If I want to build an internally-facing app, an employee-facing app on Azure, I might build it like this. I might use Azure Virtual Machines, build my app, have my users use it. Great. Why would I do this? Why would I build my next internally-facing app for my employees on Azure IaaS? Why would I do this? Well, again, one big reason to get around central IT is just fast. I can have VMs in 5 minutes. Not 5 days or 5 weeks or 5 months. I can start right now. It's a good thing. I also get some things I can't easily get otherwise. There are, for example, data centers around the world that I can use if I want to. I can get up and down scaling. Microsoft, for example, tells us that the application they use for employee evaluations internally gets used heavily twice a year. It now runs on Azure, they tell me, because during the big peak times when it's used, they run many VMs of the app, then shut down most of them during the rest of the year. When you have apps that vary a lot like that, the pricing characteristics, the pay-as-you-go, can make it very attractive to use a cloud platform. And finally, just overall lower costs. Again, if today it's the case that you believe Azure is not cheaper than your data center, you might be right. In a year, will you be right? In 2 years, no. I don't think you will. You might also choose to build an employee-facing app not on IaaS, but on PaaS. Remember PaaS? I showed you that earlier relatively quickly. With PaaS, you need not create
the VMs. With PaaS, you give it your app and say, platform, here's my app, run my app. With PaaS data solutions like SQL Database, you have less admin to do. You say, here's my data, work with my data. Great. Why would you choose PaaS over IaaS? Well, there are three big reasons. Number one, it's faster. It's easier to deploy things. You need not create VMs. Number two, there's less management. The PaaS platform maintains things for you to a great extent. Number three, since there's less to create and less to manage, there are fewer things for you to screw up. So there's less risk. Okay, so PaaS offers faster deployment, lower cost, and less risk. Why doesn't every new app always get built on PaaS? You know why? The biggest reason, in my experience, is developers often resist. Developers love control. And PaaS, while it's a Windows environment here, gives you some constraints. Developers live for control. And so I see some devs resist this. So PaaS is a good solution for new apps. Is it always the best solution? Your decision. Devs love control. A friend of mine, a guy named David Platt, makes this analogy. In America, almost nobody drives stick shifts. We drive automatics, right? You all drive stick shifts, right, in Europe? But not in America, right? In America, we all drive automatics except developers, because they want that control, right? So, all right. For new apps that face customers, you might also use PaaS, like I showed you before. Same scenario, but now you're talking to customers, the world at large, not your internally facing audience, not your employees. Why do this? Why do this? Why build an app facing customers on Azure? There are some pretty good reasons. The biggest one is scale. If you're building an app for your employees, do you need massive scale? Oh, probably not. But an app facing your customers, the general public, you might need massive scale. And for that, a cloud platform like Azure has a lot to offer, obviously. You also get up and down scaling. So very spiky apps can be effective to use here. You get high reliability. You can have replication. And there's a bunch more stuff. There's even support for some of these newer scalable technologies like NoSQL databases. If you care about that, tomorrow afternoon we're going to talk that surveys NoSQL on Azure. So I'll look at that bottom point there in more detail. There's a bunch of reasons why you might choose to use Azure for apps that face customers. And they aren't just the same as those that drive you to use Azure for employee-facing apps. Again, lower costs, said before, and potentially, if you choose to use PaaS, faster and easier to deploy. So for apps that face customers, there's a bunch of reasons why a cloud platform like Azure can make sense. Let me just try to summarize this story here, because the truth is that I could build almost any app on Azure. There are, however, scenarios that shout out to you, build this app on Azure. There are some that are really clear Azure solutions. So I'd categorize them like this. If you need fast access to computing resources with no commitment, that is the essence of strategic IT, right? You want quick access to resources with no commitment. You might fail, might shut things down. That's a great Azure scenario. Like what? Well, marketing websites or any app that's innovative and might fail, high risk. This is why all startups use cloud platforms. Makes great sense. And marketing websites, the marketing guys want them up right away. And how long will they last? You don't know. If the campaign's a big success, they could be very large and last for a year. If it's a failure, they run two VMs and are shut down in a month. That's a great cloud platform scenario. Scalability without risk. If your app requires massive or global scale, and again, consumer web apps, the Harry Potter site, Pottermore, runs on Azure. No surprise, right? Massive scale sites. If your app has very spiky usage, very spiky apps make really good sense, like online ticket sales, where there's a giant peak when popular acts go on sale, or are there other examples? In Australia, the government of New South Wales wanted to offer these tests, educational tests, once a month around the country. To actually buy the hardware would have cost them tens of thousands of dollars, actually hundreds of thousands. They built the thing on Azure, and they have this giant bunch of VMs running one Saturday a month and then shut them down. It cost a few $100. That app was only feasible on Azure. So very spiky apps can be a very good choice for public cloud platforms. How about this? There are people who choose to build on Azure because it's more secure in their mind than running the app on premises. What's an example of that? I run across this quite a lot. The example is a mobile application where the back end has to go into enterprise data centers. For example, I know a firm built a mobile app to let customers access themselves from their phones their utility information, information about power usage and so on. But when they went to the IT people in the company and said, we're going to do this, let customers come in to your systems and access their billing and data and so on, the IT guys said, no, you're not. You're going to have customer mobile phones come through our firewall to access enterprise data centers? I don't think so. No possible way. And so what they do is they move the data periodically from enterprise data center to Azure. And the apps go to Azure because it was deemed too big a risk to have the phones actually go into the data centers. There are cases where people think Azure is more secure than their on-prem data center. And finally, anybody who doesn't want in-house IT. Who is this? Well, it's all startups. Startups just don't do data centers anymore. And what I would categorize as progressive businesses. I know that we as IT folks have a hard time with this. But the people who we work for don't really want data centers. They want the benefits of apps and data, not data centers. And so I see more and more progressive businesses doing this, going to the cloud to get what they want rather than what they don't want. The benefits, not the burden of data centers. Finally, my last category, my last scenarios. New parallel apps. They deserve their own category. Parallel apps are those that run simultaneously in multiple VMs. And there are two big, broad categories. The first category runs lots of VMs to get lots of compute power. This is commonly called HPC, high performance computing. And so in Azure, there is the HPC server pack, HPC pack on Windows Server, that knows how to create a cluster of IaaS VMs, VMs on Azure. You can then deploy parallel applications and get the results. Why is this interesting? It's interesting because parallel apps are interesting. What are examples? Simulation. If I want to simulate a car crash or bond portfolio performance or something else, running a simulation in parallel can make very good sense. The more VMs I have, the better my results are going to be. But without this, I've got to build and maintain my own physical set of servers, my own cluster on premises. Expensive. Only big firms can do that. With this, anybody can access Azure, set up a cluster of VMs, pay for them for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, shut them down. Simulations are now accessible to all size firms. This democratizes access to this kind of scenario. It's a big win. And the other big category of parallel apps is where you want lots of VMs, not for lots of CPU power, but rather for lots of data access. This is big data. And here, there's a single technology that has ruled the world. It is Hadoop. Azure provides a managed Hadoop service on Azure called HD Insight. It will deploy a cluster for you. You can deploy your app, commonly built in this model called MapReduce, and get the results. Why would you do this? The exact same reasons as before. The appealing thing is you need to pay for the VMs you use when you use them. You need not buy, build, and maintain your own hardware cluster. That's a huge win for lots of organizations. Also, you need not have the in-house skills to create and manage those clusters for HPC or for Hadoop, because the platform does it for you. That's also a big win, especially for Hadoop, where the skill set to do this is hard to find. So, there you have it. For strategic IT, I've broken new apps into three big buckets: employee-facing, customer-facing, and parallel applications. Other ways to do this, those are my favorite categories. And so, we're done. Let me end where I began. I believe public cloud platforms really can provide lower cost, higher availability for utility apps, and faster access to resources, better support for strategic applications. In fact, it is my experience, having done this talk around the world to lots of audiences, it is my experience that this is true, that at least one of these scenarios probably has value for every enterprise right now, utility, strategic, or both. Let me ask the room, let me ask you, who in the room believes that at least one of the things I've walked through has value for your organization today? At least one. Right. I see almost all the hands. Wherever I go, I do this talk, and with this question, I see all the hands. That's why I began with the assertion that I did, because my belief from my experience is what you just showed me, that these have value for almost everybody. And so, my last comment, my last question to you, what are you waiting for? Thank you.